welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host of this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show anytime, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Abigail Bergeron, who is doing her PhD in philosophy under the supervision of Dr. Paul Fairfield. Welcome to Grad Chat, Abigail.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And before we dive into your research, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your academic journey up until this point. So where have you been and what brings you to Queen's?
Yeah, for sure. I came to Queen's a few years ago now to do my master's in philosophy. Before that, I went to Swansea University in the UK for law school. And then before that, I was at Trent University for philosophy. So I decided to come to Queen's because I've heard great things about Kingston. It's a beautiful city. And then I decided to stay here, and I ended up doing my second master's in law here at Queen's under Dr. Jacob Weinrib. And then now I'm in my third year of my PhD here with Dr. Fairfield.
Oh, very nice. So you've been to many places.
Yes.
And studied, it sounds like, a variety of topics, which I'm sure sounds like they're converging in your PhD. So hopefully we can chat about that a little bit more. So your current dissertation research focuses on the American philosopher Albert Borgmann. Can you tell us a little bit about what your project entails?
Yeah. So Albert Borgmann was an American philosopher who was born in 1937 and actually passed away relatively recently in 2023. He wrote several books on the philosophy, namely of technology, is what he's known for. But he also wrote about ethics, about ontology, philosophy of reality, philosophy of science, and a theory of history. So there's a lot more to Borgmann than maybe is commonly known in the philosophical circles. And in terms of his specialty and what I'm working on, I'm actually trying to map, you know, his entire life and work and his legacy ultimately in like a master project. So up until now, you know, there's been a little bit of discussion about Borgmann. Most of it is on his technology stuff, like I said, and a lot of it was happening in like the 90s when all this was, you know, getting popular. So a lot less so today. He's not a big name by any means in philosophy, but I'm hoping to kind of change that and introduce him back to a new generation of scholars. I think there's been a big dearth in terms of, you know, the philosophy of technology research generally, but then also having a more holistic picture of, you know, technology and what the good life means and what community means. And Borgmann really sought to have a comprehensive project that answered all those questions. So my doctoral research is focused on then mainly three things. The first of which is, yes, to make the first long form book kind of treatment of Borgmann's life and work, instead of just, you know, there's a lot of essays and stuff, you know, applied work that I'm kind of looking at the big picture. And then secondly, to extend and defend a lot of the criticisms that kind of got unresolved in the literature back in the 80s and 90s. Borgmann never directly resolved a lot of the problems that other people brought up with regards to some of his ideas and theories. And I feel like I might be able to kind of satisfy some of those questions. And of course, now that he's gone, he can't do it anymore. So I really want to answer those kind of lingering questions and criticisms. And then the third instance, I want to demonstrate Borgmann's like continuing relevancy for today, both for, you know, the philosophy of technology, narrowly speaking, but also for, you know, a wider audience. Because towards Borgmann's later years, he really sought to write for a more general audience as well. He felt like that was the proper place for philosophy, is not always just a technical kind of puzzle or discussion among experts, but, you know, a wider drawing in of people. So that'd be my main three aspects of my project.
Oh, very interesting. Well, that sounds like a massive undertaking. Sounds like a lot of work to be done and that you're doing currently, but it sounds exciting. And how did you first become interested in Borgmann, and why did you choose him in particular to focus your doctoral dissertation work on?
I began looking and reading at Borgmann a long time ago, actually, during my undergrad for an essay I was writing. And I came across him by accident. I was reading a book that kind of talked about, in a general way, the history of philosophy of technology. But he really kind of stuck out to me. And I read his main book on technology, and I really liked that book. But I felt like there was a lot of questions that I found really interesting and that, you know, he didn't really answer. So I felt like there was a lot to discuss there. And actually, at first when I read Borgmann, I was quite critical of him. I felt like his theory was too optimistic and had too many questions, too many holes in it. But then the more that I've gone back and kind of read him for other assignments and other essays for different courses, I found, you know, how applicable he kind of is to everything. And I always knew that I wanted to do my dissertation on probably one philosopher versus a problem, because in philosophy, generally, you have a thesis or a dissertation that usually focuses on either like a problem, so like, you know, the question of truth or, you know, what is beauty, that kind of thing, or on a person. So, you know, there's a lot of people doing work on like Rawls or Heidegger or Nietzsche, you know, one of the big names. So I wanted to do a person, but I didn't want to do a big name, so to speak. I was looking forward to kind of carving out my own kind of corner to work on someone who is less known and maybe try to popularize his work and his ideas and kind of bring them forward. So Borgman really fit that because not only, you know, he's not a big name, and I do feel like he's been neglected. And, you know, the more I kind of thought about it, the more I realized he was right about like so many things. And the more I started to like reflect on his work and how it relates to my own life, you know, the more I started to feel like my own life became like better in some ways because of what he was saying and the influence he had, especially his work in ethics and, you know, kind of the virtues for daily life today, living in a technological society. And I really enjoyed his writing style, and I enjoyed his criticisms of philosophy in general. He was very critical of the profession towards the end of his career. So he said a lot of things that I can certainly relate to as a graduate student in the profession. And I found like he was a really just inspirational person the more I dug into his life and his work. So I really enjoyed kind of following his trail. I actually recently went to the University of Montana to do archival research there on his work. They hold an archive because he worked at the University of Montana for the last 50 years, actually.
Wow.
So he was there for 50 years, yes. And he had this house up in the mountain overlooking Rattlesnake Park, which is a wilderness conservation area. And it is just breathtaking. Mm. And going to Montana and like kind of seeing where he lived and where he worked and where he spent his time, like it you can see how much it informs his writing. Mm-hmm. And it definitely is a way of life that speaks to me as well. He was a big outdoorsman, hiker, a naturalist kind of person. So all of that really, really brought me into studying Borgman.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And also that you were able to visit the site recently, right?
Yeah.
And that are all his personal papers there?
Yes.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
What a collection of 50 years of work and all of the ephemera that have come with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, very interesting. The unfortunate part was that a lot of his work is very handwritten, and like he used to write in pencil, like very, very tiny little cursive writing.
Mm-hmm.
So actually going through it is less fun, I will say. I do wish that more of it was typed, but he didn't, you know, he only typed usually the last draft. So it was just drafts and drafts of this handwritten, very faint writing. So, but yeah, it was very cool to look at the archive and even get to meet some people, some of the other professors in the faculty who knew him, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to meet a few of those people and hear about kind of Borgman and his stories and, you know, what he was like as a philosopher kind of thing. So I'm hoping to go back to the University of Montana in the next few years and do more research and talk to more people about Borgman's life and legacy.
Oh, that is such a nice aspect of your project that maybe other folks who study philosophers from a more distant past don't have the ability to do. So it's so nice that you have both his words, his thoughts, but also this community with which to discuss his work and his life.
Mm-hmm.
So that is very exciting. And you mentioned in kind of your summary of your work that Borgman is really focused, or I guess his most known work is for his work on technology.
Mm-hmm.
And in our contemporary moment, technology, especially different types of, you know, generative artificial intelligence, that seems to be kind of everywhere, kind of inescapable and kind of very front of mind for many people. So does Borgman offer anything that's really unique or illuminating on the current moment we find ourselves in? And can he offer things to both philosophers and non-philosophers that we should be considering?
Yeah. In terms of Borgman's philosophy of technology, I would say the first thing is that it was very prescient in terms of he wrote his main book in 1984. And a lot of the things he talks about in that book, you know, have only come more true as time goes on. And I really do like that in a philosopher, when philosophers kind of have this ability to kind of like look to the future and make, you know, these kind of long-term predictions, and then they turn out right. I think that's a real success for philosophers. I think in some sense that is very impressive. So in terms of his philosophy of technology today, I would say that it certainly has a lot to offer the general discussion on technology.
Mm.
A lot of the philosophy of technology today coming out of, you know, academic philosophy deals with specific, you know, technologies, mainly the idea that, you know, we need to examine the benefits and, you know, issues with this one type of technology. You know, for example, you see a lot of the discussion on social media, you know, how does social media like harm people? What are the harms? Or, you know, what does free speech mean on social media? You know, these kinds of very specific questions that are very important to policy. They're very important to research and development of these technologies. But there is, I think, a missing a big picture kind of look at technology as a whole that we kind of saw back in the 50s and 60s with thinkers like Heidegger, who wrote about the question concerning technology as this kind of big way of being in the world today. And Borgman really followed Heidegger in a lot of that in terms of interpreting technology as the way we are in the world to some extent. And Borgman made it more specific, though, to, you know, our specific relationships. So his central philosophy of technology that he elucidates in his first book is that technology disrupts our relationships with, obviously, each other. You know, there's a lot of discussion about that, but also with our material world, our environments, and the things itself, right? So his whole theory he called back then was called the device paradigm. And he argued that devices were things that delivered us a product without any kind of skill or engagement with, you know, the world or with the device itself, right? And his example is a thermostat. You know, you go over and you click the button and now your house is getting warm. So with very little effort and no skill, no attention, no engagement needed, you know, you've now made your house warm. Versus before, you know, modern technology, before the, you know, the invention of central heating, you know, making your house warm would require, you know, effort, hours of effort of, you know, collecting the wood and building the fire, the knowledge and skill on how to start a fire, how to keep the fire going. You know, there's usually some kind of social, you know, grouping that kind of made the decisions on who keeps a fire going. So in a small family, it might be younger children who are in charge of that. In a, you know, big castle, it might be some of the servants. So there was this whole, like, wider context that wasn't just about making your house warm. It fed into this kind of reality that brought things together, right? There was a kind of engagement there. So his argument is that technology, technological devices, he called them, interrupt or disrupt that kind of engagement with our bodily world. And, you know, there obviously is great, you know, devices that have brought us a lot of benefits. He talks about, for example, the invention of vaccines obviously prevented, you know, horrible childhood illnesses that, you know, unfortunately killed so many children back then. But at the same time, you know, he does note that kind of experience of going through a life-threatening childhood illness as a child. And he talks about his experience as a kid growing up in, you know, the 40s and you know, suffering from, I forget which disease he's talking about. But, you know, he remembers how, you know, vivid the fever dreams were. And for him, that was a formative experience, but it's definitely experience we can move beyond now, right? So he definitely does distinguish between, you know, the benefits of technology and, you know, the drawbacks. But he thinks that, you know, there's been a little bit too, we're going too far in the one direction towards more and more easy availability of things, right? Fast food's another great example. Like, you literally just go and you order it, well, you order it on the window or on the app, and then it just, you know, appears and you get this meal and you don't really have any of idea where the food came from. Like, you know, you don't know the cow that the beef came from. You don't know the people who even made it. It's made it in a very uniform way, you know. So that's another example of kind of, he calls it commodity. So what a device is for is a commodity. So a burger from McDonald's would be a commodity. The heat that you get from your thermostat is a commodity. And he means that in not the sense of, we might think of a commodity, but a commodity for him is just the way that something has been severed from its context. So when you know, take a burger and you mass produce it in a factory and then produce it at McDonald's or whatever, it's been taken from its context, right? Compared with, you know, actually you raising the cattle and slaughtering it and going through that whole process. That's something in its context. So anyway, his theory of technology then is really, I think, accurate in a lot of ways. And I think it's, even though he's writing this in the 80s, I think we can only see today how our lives have become more deviceness. And, you know, and literally in the sense of we have, you know, iPads and smartwatches and stuff that literally give us anything we want at the push of a button. You know, Gen AI, ChatGPT, like, is kind of the ultimate device. It will it will tell you anything you want at the push of a button. And then you have to ask, like, you know, is that good for us? Is that good for our relationship with the wider world? You know, is it, you know, is there something missing when instead of, you know, going out in the world and meeting people, you know, you're just sitting on your iPad and texting? You know, is there some kind of engagement loss there? You know, and I think part of that is trying to steer us away from the feeling that we need things easier and easier and faster and better, or else we're going to be unsatisfied. It's kind of, you know, like the hedonic treadmill, right? We're just kind of, we need more and more and more. And Borgman really has a clear line that, you know, we don't, and there's, you know, there's something good to be found in effort and engagement with the world. And we need to kind of have a mature relationship with technology, he argues, insofar as we need to limit devices and our use to them to, you know, what is strictly necessary, like, you know, vaccines, and then, you know, make more room for what he calls focal practices. And for Borgman, a focal thing or focal practice is something that you can center your life around. So historical examples would be like religion, which, you know, in medieval Europe was a very focally oriented society insofar mm-hmm. as the church and, you know, God was the center of all of society. And from there, you know, people knew what they were doing, what their meaning in life is. It was all given to you, right? Insofar as being part of that kind of world. And obviously today we don't have that kind of center focality in most cultures, but we definitely can still have forms of individual focality, things that make our lives worth living, that give us meaning, that give us orientation, and that give us a way to engage with the world and with each other. And so the examples he talks a lot about are sports. Mm-hmm. Sports bring a lot of people together. Yeah. They engage the body, they engage the mind. There's a kind of excellence there that you can work towards as an individual, which is you know, a really good way to be in the world, so to speak. Art, music, gardening, mm-hmm. cooking, you know, having a family, having something you're proud of. Those kinds of things he thinks are orienting and focal. And we, you know, instead of, you know, turning to technology to make our lives easier and easier, we should be using technology instead to make more room for these kinds of practices. Mm-hmm. You know, his famous example is you can either sit at home all day and, you know, sit on the couch, or you could go for a run and then come home and have a shower. And the shower then facilitates, you know, the ease of the run. Then if it's raining outside, you don't have to be like, oh, I don't want to go outside and, you know, go for a run in the rain. You can be like, well, I can because I'll come home and shower. So in that way, you know, we're using the device of a shower mm-hmm. in a way to promote kind of the focal practice of running. So in that sense, that's how we should be kind of looking at devices instead of thinking about how more and more we can, you know, use devices to make our lives easier, right? And I think, as you said, generative AI, I think, is a really good example of how we're moving in the opposite direction mm-hmm. where, you know, instead of mm-hmm. AI doing my laundry, AI is like making art mm-hmm. and like, you mm-hmm. know, like stealing work from people and reproducing it. And, you know, that's kind of the unfortunate part, because that's going the opposite direction. We should be, you know, kind of centering around, you know, those kinds of things instead of, you know, ceding it to, you know, what is easy, what is available, what is convenient, what is effortless, and kind of, yeah. So I feel like that's definitely a prescient aspect of his thought.
Well, it sounds, like you said, very prescient for the time right now, especially as we're seeing lots of, you know, the general public and just regular everyday folks asking themselves, mm-hmm. like, you know, like, what is the point of doing certain things when mm-hmm. something else like Gen mm-hmm. AI might be able to use that? And people are really balancing, you know, what are they gaining? What are they losing mm-hmm. from using, and I guess Borgman's words, using these devices? Like, what do you gain? What do you lose? And mm-hmm. I think we need to have a serious conversation as a mm-hmm. society right now. And it sounds like Borgman can really offer us a lot to think about, you know, what are the benefits and what are the challenges by using different types of technology, and what are we willing to give up and what are we willing to hold on to as we move forward. Do you have a favorite passage of Borgman's work?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, can you tell us? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so this passage didn't appear in any of his published work until his final book, which was published posthumously in 2023. It's called Moral Cosmology, and it's kind of a collection of the stuff he was working on towards the end of his career. And unfortunately, it is kind of unfinished in the sense that he unfortunately passed away before he could finish the last chapter and kind of polish it up. So it definitely reads like that. But you can kind of see his aim at the end of that was to tie together his kind of life's work, in the sense that, you know, he started with, you know, the technology question, and then he continued through his theory of history. And he talks a lot about ethics in his Real American Ethics book in 2006. So this book was kind of a way to draw it all together and kind of see, you know, what role do we have to play in, you know, the world, people, and then mm-hmm. what is the role between, you know, science and the humanities? He talked a lot about that. Mm. And, you know, can we have a cosmology today? And a cosmology is kind of just a fancy word for saying, can we have an explanation for like why we're here and what we're doing here, right? And, you know, historically, like all cultures have a moral cosmology, right? Like, you know, Christian Europe has a very clear Christian cosmology of, you know, how the world began and, you know, where it's going. Indigenous cultures have a very clear cosmology. He talks a lot about that as well. But we obviously don't have one anymore in, you know, kind of secular Western society. And so he's trying to see if we can take, you know, from science, you know, and kind of build up a theory of the universe that's, you know, not incorrect in terms of a physics way, but gives us some kind of purpose and meaning. So that project is a bit unfinished for sure. But he at the end of the book, he cites this passage, and I think it illuminates what I was talking about earlier with focal practices. You know, I keep using the word orientation, and that's a really funny word. It's a weird word you don't hear a lot anymore. You think, what do you mean, like, orient? Like, you know, but this passage kind of illuminates what he means by orientation, what he means by having a focal thing or focal practice that centers your world. And in his later work, you know, he talks a lot about completeness. You know, we want to have a complete life, a complete world. And, you know, the kind of consumerist hedonic treadmill that we're on today and technology kind of promotes is not complete. It never can be complete, right? You can never buy too much stuff. There's always more stuff to buy. There's always more, you know, devices to have. You can always make something easier and better and more quickly available or whatever it is. And that's not a complete life. And for that reason, there's this feeling of incompleteness. So this passage is kind of illustrates what Borgman means by completeness. And is he calls it, you know, it's kind of self-warranting. Like, you know, you don't then need to define necessarily, you know, what is a focal practice. What focal practice is kind of centering. So the quote is, "There is no place I would rather be. There is no one I would rather be with. There is nothing I would rather do. And this I will remember well." And that passage actually he got from a retreat he went on back in the 50s, this Christian retreat. And he was speaking with a theologian there. And that he talks about this in actually an earlier interview, 1993 interview, but it comes back up in this final book. And then that's in the last page, actually. And I think that's also very fitting. And so basically the idea is that, you know, to have a complete life, to have a focal life, or to be involved in a focal practice is kind of to be able to say, wow, like there's no place I would rather be than eating dinner with my family, or there's nothing I would rather do than, you know, be out here running, you know. And I think we've all had that feeling from time to time, right? It's kind of like a sublime, or as people call it, might call it flow state in psychology, right? And he says, you know, we need to be, that is what the good life is. That's a source of the good life that gives us all purpose and meaning. It's kind of a universal. And in that sense, we should be focusing on making a clearing for those kinds of experiences more, right? And the technology, he thinks, you know, obviously drastically reduces those experiences because it reduces our engagement with the world. And it reduces the way we might randomly come across something or someone that we're doing and suddenly we're really actually involved in this focal thing. Right. I really like that quote at the end. I think it's a very fitting kind of quote.
It's a nice, like you said, I think it's a nice summation of what you've been discussing and kind of a way to recognize when you're hitting those those focal practices or those focal things. A nice way for you to quickly recognize if this is something that is worth your good life and the time that you have to spend on it. Oh, thank you for sharing that. What do you want people to know about philosophy in general and the role that philosophy can play in today's world as it rapidly changes and careens around? What do you want people to know about it?
It's a difficult question to answer because I feel like every philosopher is going to have a different answer. So by no means do I mean to speak for, you know, the academic philosophy profession as a whole. But I'm going to have to agree with Borgman insofar as I feel like philosophy today has become very narrow in the sense that there's a lot of people, a lot of really great work being done, a lot of diligent projects, but the projects are kind of just self-reinforcing projects. Everyone, you know, they're working on these really difficult technical questions, and there's a lot of collaboration with other philosophers on these kinds of questions, but there's not a lot of willingness to go beyond that kind of technical debate. You know, philosophy used to be, you know, at the base of everything. You know, that's where we got math and the physical sciences from and art. You know, everything was once, you know, full under the branch of philosophy, right? And over time, you know, all those pieces have kind of left and gone off to do, you know, their own thing, right? And philosophy's now been kind of left with this question of like, well, you know, what is my purpose now, right? Like kind of a retired person might be like, well, I spent my whole life working, you know, now what do I do with my free time? And I think that's caused a lot of disruption in terms of, you know, the discipline. So I'd say that a lot of the philosophers today are working on great projects, but I think they need to extend more and be maybe a little more speculative and daring. And I say that only because I work particularly in the continental tradition. So that's the tradition that came from continental Europe, is starting in the 1700s, and includes, you know, the big names like Heidegger, Nietzsche, Camus, the existentialist, Sartre. And those philosophers were more willing to take on more of a narrative or artistic style. They were often very dramatic. If anyone's ever read Nietzsche, like he's very, very dramatic. He's almost to the point of being funny. And they're very polemic in a lot of instances. They have a lot to say about things. And, you know, today the predominant style of philosophy is analytic philosophy, which came from, you know, the Anglo-Saxon sphere around the World War I, World War II. And that is closer related to kind of, you know, the sciences or maths, where they set out to solve a specific problem. So like formal logic, for example, and they set out like, you know, a logical problem. There's a lot of great work being done in analytic moral theory, which questions, you know, you know, in this case, what should we do? You know, the trolley problem, I'm sure people have heard about. Those are all very classical kind of analytic questions. And so their style is a lot more formal and a lot more, I would say, kind of limited in the sense that they're trying to be as clear and succinct as possible in their answers, which is great. But I think that there is room to do, you know, the continental kind of side of philosophy too. And I don't think there's anything wrong with a philosophy that does seek to be more speculative and more polemic, especially when we're talking about stuff like technology today, where there is lots of great work being done on, you know, the effects of this technology or that technology or what have you. But I also think there's room for a lot more, I would say, drama almost and polemicism for sure. And I think that would also bring the general public more into conversation, because I think there's been a lot of fragmentation where the general public doesn't know what philosophy is anymore, what people are doing in it. And then, you know, philosophers are just kind of like, oh, well, they don't understand. They don't like us. You know, there's, you know, kind of a inferiority complex among all philosophers, I think, that, you know, we're not the hard sciences. And what are we doing here? And I think that kind of inferiority or insecurity complex is something that all philosophers deal with. Even I would assume maybe even, you know, the ones who are famous and have great, you know, are, you know, deans of departments and stuff. I feel like even they must sometimes be like, wow, like, you know, because it's hard to do something that the rest of the world just doesn't respect or feel like it's worthy. So that can be very difficult, especially when you're starting out in your career and people are like, well, why don't you go be a lawyer? Or why don't you go do something useful for society? But the best philosophers, I feel like, were ones who were doing a public service. They're public philosophers, right? So Dewey was another big public philosopher in America in the early 20s. Borgman really tried to be kind of a public figure. So in that sense, I think philosophy should be very public. It should be community oriented. And I think it should inform a lot of the kind of public conversations that we're having. And so in that sense, I think there's a lot of room for philosophy to do that today. And I hope that there kind of is more of that in the years to come.
I think people would welcome some philosophers' opinions on things, because right now I think, like you mentioned, there's not one central focal point for, you know, secular Western society. Mm-hmm. And I think people are searching for that. Mm-hmm. There may be multiple, of course, but I think people would love to hear more from philosophers and their opinions on where we can find meaning. Mm-hmm. I think that is very, very important in the contemporary moment. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more, I guess, maybe what some of your focal things or practices are in your life. I know that you are very active outside of your research and that you have a large animal family, many cats that you are living with. Could you tell us a little bit about some of your pets and your friends, whatever, however you would define your cats?
Yeah. So I do have 6 cats. In my free time, I guess I spend a lot of that. Recently, I've become really into gardening. So the last few summers, I've been outside a lot of the time. As I mentioned earlier, I've kind of become a very much outdoors person and kind of trying to get into the more rural mindset. And I think Borgman, again, had a lot to do that. He had a lot of discussion on the impact that living in Montana's kind of mountainous wilderness area had on him and his work. And I think that the right setting is important for philosophy in terms of, you know, where you live and who you're interacting with will inform kind of your work. I would also say that doing kind of physical labor insofar as, you know, the gardening, or I love cooking, those kind of things, I feel like that is almost more philosophical than when I'm sitting down and writing. I sometimes get my most clear ideas or my best ideas while I'm engaged in something else. And it's definitely taught me some skills that I think have helped me mature as a scholar, as a graduate student, in terms of, you know, patience. Gardening is a very patient task.
Yes, it is.
Having things happen outside of your control is another thing, you know, so you never know when you will be able to write this, you know, if you want to write today, well, something might happen and, you know, you wake up not feeling well or whatever. And that used to be very frustrating for me, but gardening has kind of taught me to let things go a little bit like that. So for me, yeah, gardening and cooking are big focal practices, so to speak, that have really started to orient my life. And I actually really only started taking up with those after I moved to Kingston. And especially once I started reading Borgman, it made me think more and reflect more on how I was spending my time in terms of, you know, I want to spend less time watching Netflix or less time sitting around on my phone and more time, you know, out in the world, engaged with things and people. So gardening and cooking really kind of started that. And it's definitely, you know, bloomed into, I grow a lot of things and I love cooking. And then more recently, I've started taking up long distance running as well. And that was actually a direct inspiration from Borgman, because he talks a lot about running as well as kind of a, you know, a very clear example of focality that's kind of universal. You know, everyone everyone can run across the history of time. You know, running mm-hmm. is kind of universal to us as people. And, you know, as children, we kind of love to run. I mean, you know, children are very playful, but then you grow up and you kind of lose that motivation to want to be out in the world and engage mm-hmm. your whole body. Right. And running is really unique from other kinds of physical activity because it does engage your whole body. So, and your mind as well. And so I start doing long distance running in the summer. And I've also found that it's directly informed how I look at myself and my research because, you know, training to run more and more distances, you have to plan it out, first of all. You can't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to run 5,000 kilometers today. So you plan it out slowly and you build yourself up. And, you know, there's great days where, you know, I had a great run. And there's days where, like, I'm like, I don't like this. But Borgman never says you're going to always be happy doing full goal practices. Mm-hmm. They're not just mm-hmm. subjective, like, oh, I feel great today kind mm-hmm. of experiences. They're centering experiences. And sometimes that's work, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's tedious and painful even sometimes, right? But that's kind of how you grow, is you have these kind of conflict with yourself and you're kind of challenging yourself. So running definitely kind of taught me how to long-term plan things for bigger projects and to not get overwhelmed at the beginning, right? Because, you know, when I think, oh, I'm going to run for 2 hours, I think there's no way I can ever run for 2 hours. And then, you know, one day I do it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's pretty cool. And same with, you know, writing any kind of big project. You know, it's so easy to get intimidated by, I remember when I was working on my master's thesis and I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to write this whole long thing. Like, what is it going to be on? What am I going to do it on? And it just was like, it's so intimidating. And I can understand why so many students do struggle with that. Even the undergrad level, you know, mm-hmm. if you have some big term paper coming up, that intimidation factor is like a huge part of being an academic or a scholar, I would say, is you're always intimidated by the work of other people who are like writing these great things and your mm-hmm. work's never the same, or, you know, just the amount of reading you have to do or research you have to do. And then obviously when it comes to writing it, you're like, oh gosh, you know, kind of at the edge of a cliff, kind of queasy, like, oh, do I jump off? Do I not? And so running really kind of taught me how to kind of reconceptualize that, reframe that. So for me, you know, instead of being intimidated, it's you take it one bit at a time and you kind of say, well, I'm not writing the entire dissertation today. I'm writing one paragraph mm-hmm. and I'm not going to run, you know, 2 hours today. I'm only running for 20 minutes. And then from there, you build it up and then you look back and you see how much progress you actually made. I think that's a really good way to like kind of affirm what you're doing, right? And you, again, you're orienting yourself, you're centering yourself. So when I speak about, you know, Borgman, I'd say he definitely directly influenced my life. And I think the lives of those people around me too, because I do talk a lot about Borgman and I do take him pretty seriously. I think that's definitely informed the way I am and the way my family is. Borgman had a saying where he's like, you know, there's no greater sin than not sitting down to dinner with your family every night. He's like cheating on your wife is one thing, but not sitting down to dinner is worse. I think that was quite a funny line. And I think, again, it's kind of true in the sense that, you know, you want to gather the people around you. You want to be part of something. And, you know, sitting down to dinner with your friends or your family regularly is certainly the beginning way to do it. And, you know, running and gardening and cooking, they all kind of become interconnected as well. And then you start knitting together this whole life. And it feels really good. And in that sense, I feel like I've dodged the kind of work-life balance struggle that a lot of graduate students and like mm-hmm. young academics struggle with, right? Where, because there's always more work to be done as an mm-hmm. academic. You can always sit and read more and write more or mark more papers. You're never just done. And so in that sense, it's really easy to lose control of mm-hmm. your working schedule. And suddenly you're just working all the time and you're burnt out and exhausted and bitter. So I really feel like I've started to avoid that kind of that fall into that kind of mindset and through having this kind of knit together life. So in that sense, I think Borgman also has that to offer people is, mm-hmm. you know, a better understanding of what makes the good life. And the good life is those things that you can knit together and have a centering to your life.
Well, Abigail, thank you so much. It has been wonderful chatting with you and learning about your work on Borgman and how his ideas have influenced different aspects of your mm-hmm. life. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and best of luck with the rest of your research. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.